Talk will be just various observations about the idea of localizing black hole thermodynamics, ultimately with the goal of localizing quantum gravity. And might as well just jump into it. It's not a completely coherent thread, but I hope that you'll get out of it some semi-coherent impression. So I thought I would start with something extremely general and very well known to most people, but just to set the stage, just think about for a moment black hole entropy, which is kind of the beginning of all of this. General relativity and quantum field theory together imply that this generalized entropy introduced by Jacob Bekenstein, namely the horizon of a black hole area divided by 4h bar g plus the entropy of matter outside, never decreases. That's the generalized second law of thermodynamics, and it seems to really be true. More precisely, though, the outside entropy is a little tricky to define because outside we have quantum fields, and the quantum vacuum even is entangled across the horizon. And if we include all of the entropy of that entanglement, well, that would be infinite. And so we can't do that, so what should we do? Well, it turns out probably what we're really doing is we're introducing a cutoff, usually taken to be in the ultraviolet, and we only include the matter entanglement entropy below that cutoff. And then the area term acquires a cutoff dependence because the value of Newton's constant depends on the cutoff in the field theory. So, and then the remarkable thing is that if we change the cutoff, although we redistribute the entropy between the area term and the outside term, the sum is unchanged. So in some sense, there are two lessons here. One is that we really shouldn't take one term without the other because they go together to form a renormalization group invariant quantity. And the other is that it really strongly suggests that the meaning of the area term is some kind of entanglement entropy, albeit one that can only be properly understood once quantum gravity enters the story and regulates that entanglement entropy. So it can't be purely understood in terms of quantum field theory is what I'm saying. Moreover, just by taking seriously this entropy and its thermodynamic significance, and referring to the laws of thermodynamics, specifically the Clausius relation, that entropy variations are related to energy variation divided by temperature, that somehow the validity of that relation is equivalent to the Einstein equation. And I'll talk today about some ways of seeing that equivalence. So that in that sense, the Einstein equation is an expression of thermal equilibrium of this vacuum entanglement entropy. Another interesting just observation to think about is that, this term shows us that the area density of entanglement entropy at the horizon is 1 over 4 h bar g. So if there's more entanglement, that means that 1 over g is larger, so g is smaller, which means that matter in the Einstein equation, matter energy has less of an effect on curvature of spacetime. So spacetime is stiffer the more entanglement there is. So entanglement is like the fabric of spacetime structure. Okay, so why is the entanglement entropy finite in quantum gravity? This is not really relevant to the rest of the talk, but I just wanted to put forth this observation of like qualitatively, why should we expect that the answer should come out finite once we take into account gravity? So here's a picture of a spatial slice in a space-time, and these red wiggles are vacuum fluctuation degrees of freedom, and they're entangled across the horizon in the ground state of a quantum field. And the question is, suppose if we consider two fluctuations, b and b tilde, that are entangled and are very close together, separated by a distance L sub c. C is going to be for critical or cutoff. At what size does it become the case that the gravitational effect of the energy of these quanta localized in a scale LC is big enough that the Schwarzschild radius of that energy is actually outside LC. And when that happens, it no longer makes sense to say that this fluctuation is on one side and this fluctuation is on the other side of the horizon. And if you just put in the scaling of that, of course, you get that LC is the Planck length. So it's kind of natural that, given that the entanglement entropy is associated with pairs of fluctuations, and there's this Lorentz invariant way of specifying how far apart a pair is, namely, and when it's closer than the Planck length, we shouldn't include its entanglement entropy. So something like that, I think, is underlying the regulation, but the actual answer is something that we don't understand yet how to calculate in bulk quantum gravity, although we've made tremendous progress in how to calculate it using a holographic description of quantum gravity. In fact, ADS-CFT appears to provide a realization of exactly the picture that I described, the Ryutake-Nagy formula and its time-dependent generalization relates the CFT entanglement entropy, ordinary entanglement entropy without gravity or any UV cutoff on the theory, to bulk entanglement entropy inside an acceleration horizon. So we don't need a black hole for that to be the case, just cutting anti-de Sitter space in half. The entanglement entropy on one half is related in this way to CFT entropy. And the value of Newton's constant, that is the measure of how much entanglement there is directly determined by this sort of effective number of fields in the CFT, which is large in that holographic duality, but finite. So that regulation of the entanglement entropy certainly comes out directly out of the same thing that leads to gravitation in the theory. Okay, so that's just to warm us up for why we're interested in thinking about these things.
Yeah. I apologize, I came in a little bit late, but when you say bulk acceleration horizon, what exactly? Mm-hmm.
I mean the Rindler wedge, ADS Rindler wedge.
And when I think of Ryutake-Nagy, I can pick any shape.
Sure, you can. It's even more general than that. Yeah. Okay. I agree. I mean, I understand and I'm aware of that. Okay, so I guess that, so having said all those wonderful things, then the question is the ADS boundary essential to this whole story, both about holography and quantum gravity and the thermodynamics, et cetera? And how locally can the notions of black hole thermodynamics be applied? Can we form a kind of localized quantum gravity or quasi-local quantum gravity theory that's borrowing the structure of ADS-CFT? A related question that's much more concrete, and it's an old one, is how do we understand the thermodynamics of the de Sitter static patch, which is going to be a good example of what I'm talking about? And also the fact that in any space-time around a point, we have locally Minkowski space plus some small correction. So a small causal diamond in any space-time can be thought of as a small deformation of a maximally symmetric causal diamond. So that motivates focusing on looking at variations of maximally symmetric causal diamonds. And it turns out the Einstein equation is equivalent to the first law of thermodynamics for such diamonds. That is, it implies that first law, and conversely, all of those first laws imply the Einstein equations. But those first laws refer to a first-order variation, and you know, it suggests but doesn't show that what's underlying that first-order relation is really a non-perturbative statement that the entropy is actually maximized in vacuum. And I'll talk at the end about some evidence that that's the case, but it's still not known whether it is the case. And you also see why I'm just asking, maybe thinking along these lines might shed light on the cosmological constant problem. Okay, so just to warm up for the first law of diamonds, let's remember the first law of black hole mechanics and where it comes from. So here it is written out for the mass of a black hole, the horizon area, angular momentum, charge, electrostatic potential, angular velocity of the horizon, and surface gravity, kappa. This was first written down in 1972 by Bekenstein, who just varied parameters in the Kerr-Newman family of black hole solutions. The same year, actually, Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking found a deeper reason for this relation or way to derive it. In fact, they first derived this SMAR formula relating the same quantities, which they obtained from a Killing vector identity. So we're talking about stationary axisymmetric solutions to Einstein's equations, and some combination of the time and rotation Killing vectors is null on the horizon. That's called the horizon generating Killing vector. And just geometric identities satisfied by the Killing vector and the Einstein equations allowed them to derive this. And then they varied this and derived this first law from that. Just an interesting comment that not many people know, and I'm trying to spread it around, is that kappa, which we all know is the surface gravity, Carter actually wanted to call it the decay constant of the black hole. And for a good reason, probably. And it might have been called that had it not been for the, I guess, relative persuasiveness of members of the collaboration. Anyway, the black hole decay constant. So you can start calling it that if you want to.
Is that why decay constant?
Well, it's like if something falls into the black hole and it's emitting radiation, the frequency of the radiation it's emitting decays exponentially in time, like e to the minus kappa t, something like that. That's what he was thinking. Anyway, then a gap of 20 years, and then finally we understood really the right way to think about this from Sidarsky and Wald, and then more elegantly and generally by Wald and Ironwald, which is that the real source of this relation is diffeomorphism invariance of general relativity. And the entropy arises in this derivation through what's called another charge at the horizon. And it's actually valid for not just perturbations from one stationary black hole to another, which is what this derivation did, but it's valid for any variation, like it should be if it's a thermodynamic relation. It shouldn't require that the variation is to an equilibrium state if it's just the first order Clausius relation. And secondly, also importantly, that it generalizes this whole thing to theories besides general relativity, as long as they're diffeomorphism invariant, wherein instead of the area, there's a variation of this, of a different, another charge that is appropriate for this generalized theory. So the outcome is that diffeomorphism invariance is responsible for tying together variations at infinity and at the horizons. If you look at this, the mass and angular momentum and charge can all be defined by flux integrals at infinity. The area is defined by an integral over the horizon, and the law is a relation between those distant integrals. So why are they related to each other at all? It's because of diff invariance. Okay, so now let's look at a classic example which will get us more into this causal diamond that's the subject mainly of this talk. This is a nice picture from Gibbons and Hawking's 1977 paper on, what was it on? There were two good papers by them that year. It was like, basically they were generalizing black hole thermodynamics to de Sitter space in this paper. Actually, Kerr de Sitter. This is a Penrose diagram of Kerr de Sitter. And let's focus on, let's say, here, this region. So here's a future infinity section that looks like a future infinity of de Sitter space. And then this is like a black hole horizon, which if crossed, has a future singularity at r equals zero. Here's r equals infinity. So this then is the cosmological horizon of this patch. And this is a black hole horizon. And they derived in this paper what they called the first law of event horizons, which applied to both of these horizons. And it looks like this. So this is the matter stress energy tensor. Capital K is the killing vector that generates the horizon here. There are two horizons. So I have a surface gravity of the cosmological horizon and of the black hole horizon. They also each have an area. And then there's an angular momentum term. And they obtained this by, again, deriving a SMAR formula and then varying that. So what I want to do is actually consider the case where, first of all, we have just de Sitter space and no black hole. So I'm just going to cut this off there. And then that just drops off all the terms there except for the cosmological horizon one. And this triangle is called the static patch of de Sitter space. It's the causal intersection of the causal future and the causal past of one inertial observer in de Sitter space. And we get this simple looking formula, which looks a lot like a Clausius relation, where that's an energy variation, and that's an entropy variation, and that's a temperature. But there's something kind of fishy here, which is the minus sign. So it actually, if you look at that formula, it tells you that if you want to think about the static patch of de Sitter space as an equilibrium state, it must be a negative temperature state. And temperature is just, minus what we normally think of as the temperature of de Sitter space. The fact that you should interpret this as telling you that the patch is negative temperature was suggested, and I found in the literature only one place it was discussed, by Clem and Vanzo in 2004. Nobody picked up on it, and they didn't, and they kind of dropped it like a hot potato, I guess. I'm not sure why, because I thought they had a really cogent argument for it, and I think it seems right. It's true that if you have a negative temperature equilibrium system, like a spin system, that can only be consistent if there's an upper bound to the energy spectrum, because the weight of different probability weight of different configurations is e to the plus h over the absolute value of the temperature. So it's just not a normalizable probability distribution if there's unboundedly large energies. So you have to have an upper bound to energy. And Clem and Vanzo pointed out that actually, in a way, you do have that in de Sitter space. You can't put more so much energy inside the patch that the Schwarzschild radius of your energy would engulf your de Sitter horizon. You wouldn't be in a de Sitter static patch anymore. And also, people have argued, particularly Banks and Fischler, that this entropy of the de Sitter static patch should be somehow counting the number of the dimension of the Hilbert space of states. So if it's a finite dimensional Hilbert space, then of course the spectrum of energy in it has to be bounded above, since there are just finitely many states. So there's kind of reason that it's reasonable that it could be a system that has negative temperature. But what about the fact that we know that it has positive temperature and have known that for decades?
I suppose that the reason why it's negative is just it's free energy of the black hole. The free energy is E minus temperature times entropy, minus temperature times entropy. So that's why there's a negativity there. I suppose that. Is this wrong?
I don't understand, but we can discuss it later.
Okay.
I don't see how that explains it. Or helps to explain it. But it seems like to accept it, we have to reconcile it with the very well-known fact of the Gibbons-Hawking temperature of de Sitter space, which is positive. Meaning, if I'm carrying a thermometer in de Sitter space, freely falling, the thermometer reaches a finite positive temperature, not negative temperature. And this is just an analog of the Unruh effect for an accelerated detector. So we have to reconcile those two things. And what I want to argue on this slide is that actually they are perfectly reconcilable. And in fact, the negative temperature is necessary in order for it to be consistent with the positive Gibbons-Hawking temperature in the following sense. So here's the Gibbons-Hawking temperature. It's h bar over 2 pi times the cosmological horizon surface gravity, which is just square root of the cosmological constant over 3. And let's look at that law again there. And now let's note that by, you know, what's called these days the first law of entanglement entropy, we can replace this variation of the killing energy of the matter by the variation of its entropy times the Gibbons-Hawking temperature, if we're varying away from the de Sitter vacuum state. On the other hand, on the right-hand side, I said we have minus the Gibbons-Hawking temperature times the black hole entropy variation. So this is equal to minus that. So just combining the two onto one side of the equation states that the generalized entropy has zero variation. And it's only because this sign, this minus sign was here, that this relation became equivalent to the statement that the generalized entropy is stationary. So why should the generalized entropy be stationary? That, why is that natural? Well, it's natural if it's actually maximal and you're just making a first order variation away from it. So this leads to the idea that the entropy in the de Sitter static patch is maximal with respect to variations away from de Sitter geometry and the de Sitter vacuum. But we wouldn't, I want to emphasize, we wouldn't get this as the equivalent statement unless we had a negative temperature for the patch itself. So here's a slide just talking about some of the evidence that the de Sitter static patch does have maximal entropy. Sure.
What is delta T in the previous formula?
What is what?
So if you're talking about de Sitter, is that between one de Sitter to another de Sitter? The difference between, what is the difference between energy of,
It's a well, so there's no TAB in de Sitter, so this is like turning on a matter state other than the de Sitter vacuum.
Just taking account for the matter, not the cosmological constant part of the...
Here I'm not varying the cosmological constant. That's true, although later I will take that into account.
Okay, so only the variation of entropy due to some matter.
And to geometry variation.
But you could add a PdV term, which I guess...
Yeah, and I will later, actually.
Why isn't that here then? Because here you're saying...
Well, there you'd be changing the cosmological constant.
Oh, I see. So it's the VdV
I think.
Term. Sorry,
yeah.
Okay,
so let's just look at some thought experiment or examples of how you might... to compare the entropy of de Sitter to the entropy of other spacetimes related to it in particular, starting with just a Schwarzschild de Sitter. So you could put a black hole inside the static patch and then look at the total entropy, the cosmological horizon area plus the black hole horizon area. And the statement is that it's actually maximal when the black hole is not there. And there's various ways to formulate this maximality. You have to hold something fixed, otherwise you know, you're not going to get a maximal statement. So what could you hold fixed? One statement is just hold the cosmological constant fixed. Then that would be true. Another statement that's true is let lambda vary, but fix the volume between the two horizons, the proper spatial volume. Or another statement that's true is you could fix the energy, and this is the one that sounds the most like thermodynamics. At fixed energy, entropy is maximized. So what do we mean by energy? Here I mean the total nether charge of the patch, which receives contributions from both horizons. Because of diff invariance, the Hamiltonian in the bulk vanishes and it becomes just a boundary term and has contributions at the two horizons. And if we fix that, and because that scales with the norm of the killing vector, we have to somehow fix the killing vector scaling freedom. So I'm fixing it by just setting the surface gravity of the cosmological horizon to 1. Another thing you could do is just fix the norm of the killing vector to 1 along the freely falling, along the orbit of the killing field that's a geodesic. So other ways to fix it, then that also, under that fixed condition, this is maximized. So basically adding a black hole doesn't help you increase the entropy because the cosmological horizon area would shrink by more than the extra area you put in from the black hole horizon. You could try adding matter, but of course, matter is going to have less entropy than a black hole for the same mass, so adding matter won't increase entropy. And there's an old argument, actually, that if you assume the generalized second law, which is not what I'm doing here, and you imagine that this is a space-time that's asymptotically de Sitter in the future, then since when positive entropy crosses the horizon, if the generalized second law holds, the horizon area increases, but it can't increase by more than its asymptotic amount, which is just the de Sitter horizon area, then there must have been an upper bound in the first place on the amount of entropy you had, and it couldn't be more than the de Sitter entropy of the empty de Sitter space. This is what Busseau called the D-bound. So all kinds of different reasoning leads you to this idea that the entropy in the patch really is maximal. Yeah.
You say fix another charge that's different than the sum of the area because the surface, the kappa at the horizons is different?
Right.
So you're saying the area, which is like you weight them the same, will be maximized given that, and another charge will just have a different relative.
Exactly. So later, I will relate this later to this maximal vacuum entanglement hypothesis, which is that when you take matter entanglement entropy into account, not only counting, so basically like quantum corrections to these horizon areas, that in not just in the de Sitter static patch, but actually in small geodesic balls in any space-time, as if the Einstein equations hold, that the entropy is maximal in the Minkowski state and is less in any other state. Yes?
What do you mean by fixed volume? So are you choosing some particular slice or
yes.
The maximal volume
yes.
Slice? Okay.
Yes.
It's anchored in some way to the, like do you have to anchor it some way to the different horizons or does that not? I guess you put it at.
It hits the bifurcation, the two bifurcation surfaces.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, so, that's like, background. Now I want to go into a short phase of the talk where I'm going to talk about just technically how to derive SMAR formulas and the first law of causal diamonds in a way that's directly parallel to how it was done for black hole horizons using this walled another charge formalism. And then we'll look at what it implies when we include the quantum corrections about the role, the contribution of matter entanglement entropy, and also about the second order variation, which I don't have the final answer on yet, but we know some things about it. Okay, so the SMAR formula from Noetherology, I'm not sure this is known to everybody, so I thought it was worth just pointing it out really quickly. I guess though a lot of people know about this general formalism of Wald, which has been picked up on and made a lot of good use of in the holographic context. So in this formalism, the Lagrangian of the field theory is a D form if D is the space-time dimension. And if you vary that D form, you get, with respect to all the fields, you get equations of motion form E times field variations. There may be some index contractions in there. And then a total derivative term, because you have to integrate by parts to get the field equations. And the thing you're taking total derivative of then depends on both the background fields and the variations, and it's called the symplectic potential form theta. And from that, we can construct a current, which is just the value of that symplectic potential when the variation is equal to the Lie derivative of the fields along some vector field chi. At this point, chi is any old vector field. And then subtracting the inner product of that vector field with a Lagrangian D form. So this defines a D minus one form. And when L is a diffeomorphism covariant Lagrangian, and when the equations of motion hold, so when E is zero, this current is closed. And in fact, it's exact. It can be written as total derivative of some d minus 2 form called another charge 2 form. And this is built out of the fields and also out of the vector field chi and its first derivative. So that's the another charge form. So this is the basic identity. And now it can be integrated over any region in space-time, well, actually any d minus 1 dimensional submanifold. And if that has a boundary of R, then just using Stokes' theorem, we get that the integral of the current over R is equal to the integral of Q over the boundary. So this is the origin of the Smar formula because of the following. If chi is a Killing vector, then in the definition of the current, the Lie derivative of the fields will be zero. And if the Lagrangian is zero on shell, like it is in general relativity, because the Ricci scalar vanishes, then this term vanishes. And therefore, the current is just zero. And this becomes the statement that the integral of the another charge around all the boundaries of your region is zero. In particular, you could choose the region going from infinity, take an asymptotically flat or asymptotically flat black hole, and consider R to be the region that goes from the horizon out to infinity. That region has two boundaries, the horizon and like a big sphere at infinity. And this surface integral includes contributions from both. And on one, you get the mass and angular momentum. And on the other, you get the area. And that leads to the Smar formula. It's in de Sitter space, however, the Lagrangian does not vanish on shell. Because, like, for general relativity, it's again, it has a term with the Ricci scalar and a term with the cosmological constant. And the Ricci scalar is proportional to the cosmological constant, and those two terms don't cancel. So the net result has a term here that's non-zero, which is proportional to the cosmological constant and proportional to the integral of the Killing vector contracted with the volume form. I think I wrote that here. Oops. My computer is frozen. Oh, wow. I think I might have to actually restart it.
There's something there. Oh, it's just a PowerPoint.
Yeah, but it won't actually let me do it. So this will just take a second. Sorry about that. I guess I should have restarted it before I restarted my talk.
Ask a question since we're...
Yes.
The Smar formula in the case of asymptotically flat, so does that not give you the ADM energy? Because normally there's an extra piece at infinity when you do the...
Actually, I think you get... From Q, you just get like twice the ADM mass.
You sure it's,
you get the
something different, or is it only a factor of two in that case? Or
I'm almost positive that's true.
I think maybe in more general setups, it's not just a factor of two.
Probably. More general, you meaning different theories?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. Even maybe in different asymptotics, like ADS.
Maybe. Actually, yeah, I mean, actually have to regulate the formula in the case of ADS anyway, because things will be infinite. Oops. Somebody could tell me how to get this to not ask me to load these fonts every time I open. I would be forever indebted to you.
Then use PowerPoint. That's it.
Okay, so I think we're good to go. Yeah, sorry about that. You see that factor of two difference between the M and the omega J
term?
That's
the Smar. Okay, that's the...
Okay, so... Right, so what happens in Schwarzschild de Sitter? For this SMAR formula, like I was just saying for de Sitter, the Lagrangian, the chi dot L term doesn't vanish. It becomes lambda times a constant times the integral of chi dotted into the volume form. And this thing is like a sort of a redshifted volume of the region. This term was there in Gibbons and Hawking's SMAR formula for Schwarzschild de Sitter. They actually described it in a funny way. They said it's the negative contribution of the lambda term to the mass within the cosmological horizon. So I tried to parse what that was, and the best I could come up with is this. It contributes the same way as a matter stress tensor would to what's called the gravitating mass, what I would call the gravitating mass. It's, I don't think I wrote it down, but I meant to. It's like if you rearrange the Einstein equation and write it as Ricci tensor equals stress tensor minus 1/2 trace of stress tensor times the metric, that right-hand side combination, its time-time component is the gravitating energy density. And that's what this contributes to. The cosmological constant makes an effective contribution to that. Anyway, this thing actually has a name these days. It was named by Castor, Ray, and Trashin as the thermodynamic volume. And it turns out to be a very convenient quantity. Basically, like I said, a redshifted volume. It can also, well, yeah, okay, let's leave that aside. Okay, then the first law we can also get by just basically varying what we just did in the previous slide. So if we vary the Noether current away from a background satisfying the equation of motion, and we assume that we're varying to another solution, so the linearized initial value constraints in particular should hold for the variation, then we get a relation between the variation of the Hamiltonian that generates the flow along this Killing vector on the one hand, and a surface integral involving the variation of the Noether charge and this symplectic potential. So the usual first law of black hole mechanics, if chi is a true Killing vector, then there's no evolution along the flow of it because it's a Killing vector, nothing's changing. And that actually ends up meaning that delta H is zero. Delta H is conserved along the flow. And so we just get a relation between surface integrals. And in the case of black hole mechanics, there's one boundary where chi is zero. That's the horizon. And in the case of black hole, we have two boundaries. In de Sitter static patch, there's one boundary where the Killing vector vanishes. That's the horizon. So this term isn't there. And we just get that that variation is zero. If we add classical matter or a variable cosmological constant, something tricky happens because then this is not zero anymore. It's not zero because to describe classical fluid matter or to write a generally covariant Lagrangian in which you can vary the cosmological constant, you have to use fields that are actually not invariant under the Killing vector. Like the stress energy tensor is invariant under the Killing flow, but the fields out of which you built it are not. And that means it turns out that this is actually not zero, and you get a contribution. And you get the first law that Gibbons and Hawking wrote down. Okay, so let me then apply this to a diamond, a maximally symmetric diamond in any maximally symmetric space. So Minkowski, de Sitter, or anti-de Sitter. In any such diamond, we can always choose coordinates, S, X, and the angles, so that the metric is a conformal factor times this metric, which is actually a hyperbolic space cross time. And translating S is a conformal Killing flow because it just changes the conformal factor. And in fact, that conformal Killing vector on the S equals zero slice that cuts through the middle of the diamond is a true killing vector instantaneously. And it turns out that the surfaces of constant S here are CMC slices, constant mean curvature slices. In particular, of course, this one has zero mean curvature. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is something that hadn't been done before. I'm going to apply this technology where I don't have a killing vector, but I have a conformal killing vector, and just take what I get. I'll get extra terms because it'll no longer be true that delta H is zero because chi is not a killing vector. But this relation is derived in any case. It holds for any vector field. So this is work I did originally in 2015, and Manas Visser and I generalized it last year. The result of the calculation is this formula. And here we're allowing a cosmological constant to vary, like we just mentioned earlier. Remember, V zeta is the thermodynamic volume. And here's the matter term in the Hamiltonian that generates the flow along this conformal killing vector. So we could call that conformal killing energy of matter. And we have one more term here, which is a spatial volume variation times the extrinsic curvature of our spatial ball surface as embedded in the ball. Like at the edge here, this is a solid ball, and the boundary of it is a surface of that. And that surface is embedded in there with an outgoing extrinsic curvature k. And kappa is the surface gravity of our killing vector, which is kind of arbitrary because we can't normalize the killing vector at infinity. So whatever it is, it just scales through the equation. See, this scales with the killing vector, this scales with the killing vector, and so does that. So there's no real information in that. Let's see. So where does this delta V term come from? It comes from the fact that zeta is not a killing vector, so the gravitational contribution to the Hamiltonian is non-zero. Hamiltonian variation is non-zero. And actually, the fact that its variation is proportional to the volume variation is related to this old observation of Jim York, that if you evolve in what's sometimes called York time, the mean curvature of a constant mean curvature foliation provides a time coordinate. And if you evolve normal to that foliation, there's some Hamiltonian that generates that. And that Hamiltonian, he showed, is the volume of the spatial section. And on this S equals zero slice, the York time evolution and the conformal killing flow evolution agree up to a multiple. And so I guess that's the reason why, it's a way of seeing why we would end up getting, although it wasn't how we calculated it, the variation of the volume as the gravitational contribution to the Hamiltonian variation. I should say there's one minor miracle that happens here that I don't understand in a way that satisfies me, which is when you actually find this result, it's crucial that for this to just coefficient to turn out to just be kappa k, it has to be that the gradient of the divergence of the conformal killing vector as a one form has constant norm, except proportional to kappa k, on the entire slice at S equals zero. And just calculate it and find that it does. But I didn't see a way to anticipate it. And if it hadn't, this wouldn't have factored out as just the volume variation times that boundary quantity, the extrinsic curvature. I mean, it's very strange. The Hamiltonian is it's an integral over the whole spatial slice. You'd expect when you vary it, you'd get some integral of something that depends on the local variation. But actually, all you get is just the volume variation with a boundary quantity, namely the extrinsic curvature at the boundary. In any case, it works that way. And once again, you have the thermodynamic volume appearing.
So what's the difference between V and V zeta?
So V is the proper volume, and V zeta is the integral of zeta contracted with the space-time volume form. So if I replace zeta by a unit vector orthogonal to sigma, this would just be V. But if I have the Killing vector, which vanishes at the edges, for example, then I get this other integral, and that's the thermodynamic volume.
Is A still the area of event horizon? Do we still have event horizon? Area, what is the area?
A is the area of the boundary sphere here of the diamond. So it looks like just two points in this picture, but it's really in higher dimensions, it's a sphere, and it's the area of that. Okay, so let's make a few comments on this. This has negative temperature just like the De Sitter static patch because, for example, if I add a positive energy variation of matter, let's say I'm fixing the volume in lambda, I have a negative kappa basically times the entropy variation. In the case of the De Sitter static patch, K is zero because the De Sitter horizon is embedded as a, it's a maximal surface in the De Sitter space. So that term isn't there. And without varying lambda, then we just have the formula I wrote earlier that Gibbons and Hawking derived. Yeah, I think I'll just skip some of these points. I want to get to something else. Yeah, and I already said that. So actually, I think I will skip that.
So, sorry, just one, can you go back just once more to the previous slide?
Yes.
So we can understand that kappa over there, like as a kind of a pressure. Over there, like in a PDV.
This term?
Oh, no, sorry, it's not a kappa, it's a K.
This term?
Yeah.
Let's see.
Is there a pressure analog in this, in the first? Formula.
It's That's a good question. I guess you could try to think of it this way, but it's more, it seems appropriate to think of this as a pressure variation because, in fact, the cosmological constant does introduce a pressure. You could say, couldn't I have both? But then you have different definitions of the volume. I guess the point is that it's the thermodynamic volume that should be conjugate to the pressure. On the other hand, then, how are we interpreting this? I don't know. I mean, for me, it's the gravitational energy. But I'm not completely satisfied by my understanding of it. Mathematically, I'm perfectly satisfied. But
so they are the same in the formula when you said the two volumes have, in that formula below, the thermodynamical volume is the same as the space-time volume.
Is not the same because zeta is not the same as a unit vector.
Yeah, if it was, when it is unit.
Oh, if it were,
then
yeah.
They are the same.
Yeah. One other interesting comment, I guess, before I just leave this. This combination has a special status, which is its diffeomorphism invariant, in the sense that if I make an infinitesimal diffeo away from the maximally symmetric state with the slice being the one that we picked, in general, I'll change the area and the volume, but I won't change this combination. And I also, I don't know about this term, but I wouldn't change the matter variation because the matter was zero in the vacuum anyway. So that would be a second order change of the matter term. So you could kind of anticipate as a consequence of diff invariance that you shouldn't consider a delta A by itself, but it should be in this combination, which is diff invariant. Okay. So now let's talk about adding, basically trading the matter variation, which appeared as an energy, for an entropy. Remember before in reconciling the negative temperature of De Sitter space patch with the positive Gibbons Hawking temperature. What we did was we said, well, that energy variation of the matter could be looked at instead as an entropy variation. And then combined with the area term, you get a statement about generalized entropy. And you can do the same thing here. At first, we can only do it for conformal matter because we only have a conformal killing vector. So the conformal killing energy variation is only related to the entropy variation in a diamond for conformally invariant matter. So in that case, we can do the same thing we did before, and then the matter Hamiltonian variation is traded for an entanglement entropy variation, which combines with the area to make the generalized entropy variation. For non-conformal matter, we don't have that simple relation between the conformal killing energy variation and the entropy variation. In other words, we don't have the first law of entanglement in that case. So what can we do? Well, we could, this isn't what I meant to show. What's going on? What? I thought I changed this talk.
This has been recovered file one.
Oh, recovered. Thank you. Thank you. Here we go. So for conformal matter, it would be the case that the expectation value of the conformal boost energy of the matter is the, what I call the Hawking temperature here, cap just h bar over 2 pi times the matter entropy variation. For non-conformal matter, I'm going to add another term. And I'm only going to try to make this work for small diamonds now, meaning small compared to the radius of curvature of the spacetime, small compared to any variations in the quantum state of the matter, and small compared to any length scale in the matter quantum field theory. So a very UV expression. This is what I used back in 2015 in trying to derive the Einstein equation from stationarity of the generalized entropy. And so I was just guessing maybe a formula like this holds, where X is something, you know, I didn't know, but it should be boost invariant. So if I take this is associated with the conformal killing vector of this diamond, fixing the center, if I boost the diamond, I needed it to be true to derive the Einstein equation that the term I added, this X term, doesn't change. And so I just guessed that maybe that's true, and then show that if it's true, I could derive the Einstein equation. The relation was checked by Antony here, and also by Horacio, Damian, and Rob, using holographic methods in the latter case, using conformal perturbation theory in the former case. And they showed that, first of all, found the form of the X that has to be varied. And I think maybe not in the case of Antony's paper, but in this one, the method they used showed that, in fact, this delta X really is Lorentz invariant, boost invariant of the diamond. So it seemed like this relation does hold. The X you get depends on the size of the ball, but that's okay for the derivation I'm running. And if you then use this relation and plug it into the previous first law, you see then the matter energy variation has disappeared. Instead, I have a generalized entropy variation, and I have a combination of this X variation with what I'm calling now little lambda, where little lambda is whatever cosmological constant variation I happen to put in my consideration. The reason I want to rename it little lambda is to just observe then that the only thing that matters is this combination of variations, which is like the net cosmological constant variation. And if that thing is zero, that is, if I compensate this effective cosmological constant variation by another variation of my free cosmological constant knob so that the net cosmological constant doesn't change, then I just get the statement that at fixed volume, the generalized entropy is stationary. And that was the entanglement equilibrium hypothesis that I was making before to derive the Einstein equation. So this is a different way of formulating that, how to handle the non-conformal matter in the context of that derivation, which is just to cancel off the matter-induced cosmological constant variation by like a counter-term one. Yeah.
In that middle line, are you assuming something about the matter being at equilibrium, or?
I'm assuming variations away from the vacuum state, but otherwise not.
Away from the vacuum.
Yeah.
But the unvaried state is equilibrium in that sense.
Yeah, in that sense. Yep. Okay, I didn't want to include that. I think I'm just going to end then with a different source here, just four pages of another document. Where is it? Ah, sorry about that. I thought I would have it up, but since I closed stuff. These are actually slides that my student Batul Bani Hashemi made for a recent APS meeting, and I'm just going to show a couple of them. So this is about the second order variations, and this is what I'll end on. So what we've seen so far is that it does seem like the Einstein equation is directly related to a first order statement that's like that the vacuum of a maximally symmetric space is in equilibrium, and anything else that satisfies the Einstein equation is near there at first order. But what about second order? Is the entropy in the de Sitter static patch really maximal? Is it really maximal in a diamond, in a maximally symmetric diamond, compared to nearby states? I don't know how to check at finite differences, but we could try to check at second order. And so what I'll show you now at the end is just a few pieces of the calculation at second order that are consistent with it being maximum, but we don't have all the pieces calculated yet. So the strategy is to look at that variation between the Hamiltonian and the nether charge and look at its second order version. Now, at second order, the nether charge is not just the surface gravity times the area, because the nether charge actually involved the derivative of the killing vector, which ended up being the surface gravity times the binormal to the bifurcation surface where the killing vector vanishes. But that relation is only true at first order. And at second order, Anthony actually showed in this paper that we wrote together with Jose Senovia the following formula. For the second order variation of the nether charge. So it's the area variation plus another term, and that term is manifestly positive. Actually, non-negative, because it could vanish if the variation is such that the killing vector remains tangent to the boundary of the domain of dependence of the ball at second order. But if you just take that then and combine this with this and use the fact that the temperature is minus kappa, then this becomes the statement that the second order variation of the free energy, because this is like the energy and this is like the entropy term and minus the temperature, I mean, plus the temperature, because the temperature is negative. So when I put it on that side, it becomes minus the temperature. This shows that the second order variation of the free energy is negative. When we first saw that, we were a bit shocked because in thermal equilibrium, the free energy should be minimized, and here it's maximized. But actually, that's correct. If the temperature is negative, the free energy is maximized in equilibrium. So this looks good, but we haven't included the quantum corrections yet. And also, like I said, this isn't, there is a, this could be zero for a special set of variations. So what if we try to include now, and this is the last thing, the matter, the quantum corrections to this, can we still show that the second order variation is negative? Well, so here's the matter term that we left out before. Here's the term I just wrote before. I'm just subtracting the matter term from both sides here. I guess I should explain better. The total Hamiltonian is a sum of the gravitational, the metric piece, the cosmological constant piece, and the matter piece. And I'm just solving for the metric and cosmological constant piece on this side, and then using the relation I just showed you before for the total Hamiltonian in relation to the nether charge and subtracting the matter Hamiltonian. Now, it turns out that there's a particular sign of the second order variation of the matter Hamiltonian expectation value, shown, for example, in this paper by Kelly, Kunz, and Maroff. It's equal to the second variation of the entropy plus something which is positive. So if we combine that with this, then we get that the second order variation of the gravitational term and cosmological constant term is the generalized entropy terms, because this adds to the area to give the generalized entropy, minus something, both of whose contributions are positive. And therefore, that if we define the free energy as this quantity, gravitational term plus lambda term in the Hamiltonian minus the generalized entropy, then the second order variation of that is negative. I'm not sure why this is the right, or whether this is really the right notion of energy for the free energy that we're interested in, or putting it differently, why fixing this is the condition under which I would expect the generalized entropy to be maximum. But we're just kind of being led by our noses to try to be instructed as to how to understand this thermodynamics. What's missing in this calculation is, first of all, what should I say? How is this using conformal? Yeah, I think this relation was only derived for conformal matter. So what I've said so far only applies for conformal matter. And also we've left out cross terms. So we considered the second order variation in the area and the second order variation in the matter energy, but what about second order variations that have one variation of the matter state and one variation of the geometry? Those we haven't analyzed yet. So, bottom line is I don't know whether it's really true that the entanglement entropy is maximized in the vacuum, but it seems like there's plenty of evidence that it might be. And I guess I'll stop there. Thank you.
Talk about a negative temperature in like a spin system. I feel like it's usually brought up in the context of a very like an unstable setup. Do you know, like, would that play? Is that avoided somehow in gravity? Or
So my understanding is that it's not intrinsically an unstable thing unless it's in contact with a positive temperature system. Okay. Now, a diamond, by definition, is the domain of dependence of a region that's not in contact with anything else. So I'm not sure. So I don't see immediately any source of instability that would be caused by that. But maybe, yeah, I don't know if that's the right way to look at it. Yeah.
So assuming that you know you can prove your conjectures, what do you think you learn? What will it teach you from the point of view of quantum gravity? So where would be the next step for you?
If I could prove that the entanglement was maximized?
Yeah.
I guess it's telling me, I feel like it's telling me that the, it gives a way to characterize the ground state that's not an energetic characterization. I mean, normally we think of the ground state as the lowest energy state, but for that to be meaningful, I have to know what's the time translation with respect to which I'm defining energy even. And in quantum gravity, it's not clear to me that that's the right way at all to look at it, but I wanted some other way to understand what is the vacuum. Mm-hmm. So this would provide potentially a different, completely non-energetic way to characterize what the vacuum is. Now, how it would be used, I guess then given a candidate, you know, structure of a quantum gravity theory, I could then look for the state that maximizes this entropy to find its vacuum, to define its vacuum. But I don't have a program set out for how I would do that or which theory I would use.
Could you apply it to different theories or different programs to see
maybe
how applicable that is?
Yeah, I mean, like, could you apply it to
string theory or
Or loop quantum gravity? I mean, there's an example, like how you could be able to describe local quantum gravity states in loop quantum gravity, but without having the slightest idea of what the Hamiltonian you should minimize is. But so you could still try to characterize a state which has the maximal entropy in something like this causal diamond. And if you knew that that's the way the vacuum should behave, basically from working from the ground up, then that would be a guiding principle.
You would have to have a quantum analog of what you call a diamond, causal diamond.
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And mine is more naive than yours, I think. So I've got a cosmology question, which I hope it's naive and you can answer fast, which is, in cosmology, we're used to hear that the generalized entropy of the cosmic horizon is of order in natural units 10 to the 120. And that, and so you are claiming that's the equilibrium state, right? So that's the maximum entropy of the vacuum, because if it's in the sitter. We are also used to hear that if all the black holes in galaxies were collapsed in a huge black hole, just one, the entropy in our cosmic horizon, within our cosmic horizon, is also 10 to the 120. And so given those two numbers, since they are the same, and the statement is that the entropy of the vacuum is larger than the entropy of a black hole, we should expect them to be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know where that second number came from that you said.
Oh, it's the Roger Penrose way of computing the entropy in gravity within, if we consider that most of the mass in galaxies is in the form of a supermassive black hole in the center.
But why would it be equal to the cosmological horizon entropy?
I have no idea. That's the number that you get.
Oh, I see. No, that's interesting. So.
But I didn't get it wrong, right? You're claiming that, or the statement is that the generalized entropy, entanglement entropy of the vacuum is the maximal, entropy.
Yeah. Well, that would be consistent with it as long as there's like enough of a factor of two so that if all of that matter entropy crossed the cosmological horizon, that the asymptotic cosmological horizon would still be, you know, would be the proper horizon area given the ultimate cosmological constant.
Uh-huh.
So that would be, all you need is a factor of two or something to satisfy that, I think. Although I'm actually shocked that it's anywhere near it. So I'd like to look at the numbers you're talking about. Like, are we off by a few orders of magnitude, or is it like sharper than that, the equivalence you're saying, because it would surprise me, actually, I guess.
Yes, that's exactly the surprise, is that
that's interesting.
It's the same.
I don't think I was aware of that.
When you are at 120, a couple of orders of magnitude, it's already like almost a factor of, it's the same.
Yeah.
121.
Yeah, but... yeah, it actually brings in the question of how far out of equilibrium, so to speak, is the process of all that stuff crossing the cosmological horizon and clearing it out. Is there a huge entropy increase when that happens? Yeah. And if so, then we sort of have too much entropy to begin with, and there's a contradiction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know how that works.
I'll talk to you later.
Yeah.
There used to be a way of describing your research program as you were doing this semi-classical analysis to get conditions or advice for imposing on the real theory, which was discrete. And the word discrete, if I didn't hear right, didn't appear so far in your presentation.
Right.
So I want, if you're still thinking that, I'd like to bring you out.
Oh, I'm actually more agnostic than I used to be.
Oh, you were not very agnostic at all, so.
Yeah, right. So now I am. So that's more, one is more than zero. I mean, yeah, basically, yeah, I did come at the whole subject thinking a lot about discrete space-time, and then the problems that that has with satisfying with happening in a way consistent with Lorentz symmetry eventually drove me into the more agnostic state, basically. I don't know how to, and also I guess I have to say, in holography, which I take really seriously the lessons of, first of all, it's not really like there's any discreteness, but we still have a regulated horizon entropy, but it's regulated because of non-locality. Somehow the local notions we use in space-time get fuzzed out when you try to look at them too sharply. And I guess my guess is that that lesson is probably really a valid one, that whatever we end up doing, that should be a feature of how the UV divergences of entanglement entropy and maybe of other things in space-time are regulated, not so much maybe by discreteness, but by non-locality.
It's not clear to me they're different.
No, they might be compatible because the thing, yeah, the ultimate thing underlying the non-local system might be discrete. But sort of the first step of resolving the divergences seems to be not making things more non-local, not making them discrete locally. But I don't know.
Maybe could you just briefly elaborate on the last point of path integrals?
Oh yeah, I'm glad you asked. That's really kind of a separate point, so I didn't mention it, but in parallel to all this, I've been wondering what's the right like thermodynamic ensemble in a path integral language for de Sitter space. You know, there's that Gibbons-Hawking paper does talk about the partition function and even like derives an entropy from it, but I found their discussion completely obscure and I couldn't understand it at all. And I actually don't believe it makes sense. So what would make sense? Lately also Batul and I have been looking at the, instead of the canonical partition function, the microcanonical one for de Sitter space. So that brings up an old work by Brown and York. Everybody's familiar these days with Brown and York's boundary stress tensor because it came up in holography and is useful. But at the same time they were doing that work, they also introduced the idea of the microcanonical ensemble defined by a boundary spatial geometry. So you think of like a cylindrical boundary of a region of space-time. On one slice, fix a spatial geometry and fix the boundary stress tensor energy and momentum density. And they said you should think of that as a microcanonical boundary conditions, fixed energy density and momentum density and spatial geometry. And then they said, the entropy, the microcanonical entropy then would be just the number of states, the dimension of the Hilbert space with that value of the boundary conditions. And to compute that, they wrote the trace of a delta function that sets that those quantities equal to their boundary values. And then they wrote that delta, that trace as a path integral, and they got this microcanonical path integral, which could be calculated by a saddle point approximation and gives you like black hole entropy. You can apply that to De Sitter space also, which we've been doing recently, or to Schwarzschild De Sitter. And I think in a way that makes sense physically, derive the entropy of De Sitter space in an ensemble, but not thermodynamic one, because you see, De Sitter space, the temperature and the entropy are not independent. I mean, like, once you specify the cosmological constant, the horizon area is fixed, and the temperature is fixed, and you can't, like, you can't do what you do in black hole thermodynamics, which is fix the period of Euclidean time at infinity and vary the partition function with respect to that. You just can't vary it. So what are they fixing? What period are they fixing? It doesn't make any sense. It's like you can't say a circumference of a great circle on the De Sitter sphere. That's what they actually did. But that doesn't make sense because in an ensemble, they're supposed to be summing over all geometries, and not all geometries even have a great circle. So what are they fixing? It's unlike the case with a black hole where you've got a boundary at infinity where you can just fix the temperature.
Where we calculate the entropy of the Schwarzschild-De Sitter without fixing the Euclidean time. Why? Fixing the Euclidean time is not essential.
Sorry, how would you calculate it? The entropy?
So they just claim that we can calculate the entropy even in the existence of the conical singularity, just cut off the conical singularity and calculating the boundary term of the Einstein-Hilbert action on the boundary. It's a bit technical though.
Maybe you could explain that to me later, actually. I'd like to see that. I didn't understand the logic of what they really did was they spoke as if they had defined a partition function, but I didn't see how it was defined. Then they evaluated the undefined thing in the saddle point approximation by just getting the classical action. And then they said, okay, well, that tells us what the free energy is. And since the energy vanishes, it tells us what the entropy is. So it all like, if it goes by really fast, it sounds right. But then when you think about what they're doing, at least to me, it made no sense. But if you made more sense of it, I'd really like to understand it.
I had a couple of questions. First of all, can you restate again in the end your conjecture about the maximization of the entropy or the minimization of the free energy or maximization of the free energy?
Yeah.
After all is said and done, what is the conjecture?
The conjecture is that, let's say you take small balls in a sufficiently small ball, then any state other than the vacuum will have less generalized entropy than the vacuum would, let's say at fixed volume inside the ball, where by volume I mean volume of the maximal slice.
But volume in a spatial ball, you mean the domain of dependence of a spatial ball?
Yes.
So take any topological ball.
Yeah.
Constant mean curvature, like this. Just take any space-like object which has the topology of the ball.
Oh, well, wait. It should be like a small geodesic ball. So I guess
it should be constant. Zero curvature, is that it? Geodesically, when you say geodesic?
Well, like taking a point and going out a certain distance.
Oh, okay.
Along all radial geodesics.
Take apart, make a time-like vector, go out a certain radial distance along all the geodesics orthogonal to that time-like vector.
For example.
That gives you a ball. Take its domain of dependence.
Yes.
Okay. And hold fixed the distance or hold fixed?
The volume, actually.
The total volume.
Yeah.
But how, when we make the variation, how do we identify what's the same ball? If you see, I mean, is the volume always the volume of something produced in this way? By going on a certain geodesic distance. You see what I'm asking?
I'm not sure I need to identify the same ball because I'm saying any ball except one in the vacuum would have less entropy than a vacuum ball.
Any ball as long as it's produced in this way.
Yeah. I'm not so sure that it's necessary that it's produced in exactly this way, to be honest, but that would be one way I think I'm happy with.
And then the entropy is, now what? It's the entanglement entropy?
The generalized entropy that you would associate with the ball. So the area over 4 plus the entanglement entropy.
The area of the boundary of the ball.
Yeah.
Plus the entanglement entropy across the boundary of the ball.
Right.
In some hypersurface that of which the ball is part.
Right, but it's independent of which hypersurface.
Yeah. Depending on how you introduce the cutoff. The,
yeah. Yeah, you have to regulate.
Okay.
If you end up more visual, that will be around until Friday.
Yeah, including Friday.
Including Friday, of course.
In fact, including Saturday.
Okay.
I'm leaving Saturday night. Thank you.
Thank you.